Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This podcast explores themes of murder and rape. Listener discretion is advised.
Why are all these murders here? Why?
Well, one reason is that we have a homicidal maniac who's been running around and we know he's killed 10 people.
It was clear that he'd been beaten to death about the head.
She's gonna hitchhike. She was hitchhiking.
Mullen immediately started stabbing him to death.
From 1972 to 1973, locals in Santa Cruz, California were terrorized by not one, but two serial killers. Their names were Edmund Kemper and Herbert Mullen. They operated independently and over the course of 11 months claimed the lives of 21 individuals. Young children, teenagers, female hitchhikers, even a priest was slain. No one was safe. I'm Dr. Michelle Ward, and this is Mind of a Monster, The Co-Ed Killer and Herbert Mullen, Episode 2, Investigating Murder. On May 7th, 1972, two students, Anita Lucchesa and Marianne Pesch, go missing after hitchhiking a ride. They're never seen alive again. But 3 months later, Santa Cruz investigators make a macabre discovery on the Loma Prieta Mountain. The remains of a human skull. Terry Medina was a detective with the Sheriff's Department at the time.
The investigation into these remains was pretty skimpy. You were checking what we then call CINI, which is the state database, and NCIC, the National Crime Information Center, on missing persons. The sheriff coroner, of course, is then tasked to try to find out who these people are. So accessing these databases, find out who's missing, we needed the help of a forensic odontologist.
I'm fascinated by this period in forensics. We rely on DNA so much today to identify both perpetrators and victims. But this was before all of that, when criminal profiling was still in its infancy. We have two missing students from Fresno College and a human skull discovered on a mountainside near Santa Cruz. With no way to immediately identify the remains found on the mountain, I want to understand how law enforcement figured out who the remains belonged to. What were the menu of tools that the Sheriff's Department had at their disposal?
Well, so a crime scene is a crime scene, and sometimes it's a really good crime scene. You've got a lot of things there, and sometimes it's like finding these bodies out in the mountains. But it's still treated as a crime scene, and you have to carefully document everything, the area. So we had two people that would carefully photograph the area, photograph the remains, the bones. We would take samples of all the leaves and the dirt and the branches from the area, carefully draw, you know, crime scene sketching the area, measure how far from the road. All this stuff takes hours and hours, and in some crime scenes it takes days, because you never know where this case is going to go. And if you don't do all of the work, when you do get a break, if you don't have everything collected right, then you wind up with nothing. So it's pretty painstaking. We didn't have DNA back then. Later on in these cases, you know, we were putting actual body parts together to try to make one whole skeleton and figure it out.
So you still had a lot of technology and sophisticated people to help.
Yes, we did have that, you know, and that's what helped you identify a male versus female bones and bodies, and bones that were from animals and bones that were from humans. And, you know, you just needed that kind of expertise.
Mickey Alufi was also a detective at the scene and a close friend of Terry's.
I've known Terry since we were teenagers, both raised on the west side of Santa Cruz. And we're still good friends to this day. We play golf every Monday. So, you know, he and I go way back. In fact, we were detectives together in the same office for a period of time before he transferred to the what they call the scientific investigation section. But things were so, I don't want to say poor in those days, but we had one telephone for the two of us on two different desks. So we had it on a swivel. If it was for me, he would swivel it my way. If it was for him, I'd swivel it his way. So things, you know, they're a little tight. Terry and I go way back.
When did you get involved, or how did you become involved?
As I was the detective with the least amount of seniority, when they discovered a skull up on Loma Prieta, they figured, oh, let's give this to the new guy, you know. So I ended up getting that case. And it was one of those things where the skull had been there for some time. It was hard to determine if it was male or female or where it came from or anything. So we had to go through the whole process. We were trying to determine blood type, was it male, female, that sort of thing. And eventually we did a dental chart on it. In fact, we used my dentist. He did the chart on that skull. Later, as the person was identified, they compared the dental charts, and her dentist went to school with my dentist, so they marked their charts in the identical way.
The dental tests reveal the identity of the skull. It belongs to 18-year-old Marianne Pesch. But there's still no sign of her friend who she was with at the time of her disappearance, Anita Luchessa. No one has a clue that both have been abducted and murdered by the same man. And that same man, Edmund Kemper, is just getting started. He's modified his 1969 Ford Galaxy 500 to facilitate his murder spree. The lining of the trunk has been ripped out. He has a chapstick ready to drop into the lever of the passenger door to trap his victims inside. He has tape, weapons, and he's drawn up a sickeningly detailed criterion to execute his plans, as he would later outline to psychologist Donald T. Lundy.
What are the criteria? Can you list them specifically?
Basic safety situations where I have to be aware of what I'm doing completely and totally. Going on towards it, this is a priority level to attack, we'll call it. I had to make sure there weren't any cops around. I had to make sure too many cops had not passed around or passed by in traffic. You know, one cop might have seen me one time too many in that neighborhood and figure something out. So I'm following. If there were too many cops around, I wouldn't do it in that area. I'd go somewhere else. Number two was I made sure nobody they knew stayed behind, because they would remember what kind of car I had. And my third rule was never to trust them.
On September 14th, 1972, a month after the discovery of Marianne Pesch's remains, a 15-year-old girl in Berkeley misses the bus to her dance class. Her name is Aiko Ku, and she decides to hitch a ride to the class instead. What she doesn't know is that Edmund Kemper is behind the wheel. Aiko Ku has a passion for dance. She's already accepted invitations to perform locally and is finishing a routine ahead of a performance that's scheduled to take place in St. Louis. Her friend Hazel remembers her fondly.
I knew Aiko when we were 12 years old to 15 years old. And I was very drawn to her. She was friendly. She had a wonderful smile. She was smart. I enjoyed her sense of humor. Very ambitious. I think she wanted to be a doctor. And I knew she would be a doctor because she was really smart. And I envied her smartness. I had to work to be an A student. She worked hard and she was an A-plus student. And she's very disciplined. She was very easy to like. She was a very likable teenager. And we had a great time together.
Hazel and Aiko were both only children and had a special bond.
We were both born in May 1957. And we were both being raised by our moms. And our mothers were pretty tough ladies. They had very high expectations of us. They wanted us to work hard. They respected our intelligence. And they worked really hard because they wanted for us to have a good life. And because we were both half Korean, half Caucasian, we didn't have any siblings. We didn't have any cousins. We didn't have aunts or uncles. I did not have any grandparents. I think Aiko had a grandmother. So we were really felt very isolated in terms of in the family sense. We just had our moms. So when we met each other at Korean dance class, we were immediately drawn to each other. And because we were taking lessons from a teacher in San Francisco, we spent quite a lot of time on the bus, because we had to take the bus from Berkeley to the East Bay Terminal, and then from the East Bay Terminal out to the Richmond District, where our teacher was. So, you know, it's a good 2.5 hours each way. So can you imagine? 2 12-, 13-year-olds, 5 hours just talking the whole time. It was just like this endless, you know, chat, chat, chat. And so we became very close. It was just such a wonderful relationship.
Aiko had started hitchhiking to get from place to place. She seems incredibly young to me to be doing this.
Hitchhiking was a normal thing to do for older people in college or in their early 20s. It was not okay to do at our age. I did not hitchhike. I would have never hitchhiked. And what happened was before Aiko was kidnapped, I was on my way to Alta Bates Hospital. And as I was waiting for the bus, I looked across and I saw Aiko. And I was so excited because I hadn't seen her for about 3 or 4 months. And I was all ready to, I was like, oh, do I cross the street? And I was ready to say hello and wave my hand. And then I saw her stick her hand out, her thumb out. She's gonna hitchhike. She was hitchhiking and I was in shock. I was like, what is she doing? I just stared and I remember, oh my gosh, what do I do? Do I run over and try to tell her? I don't think you should be doing that. We're only 15 years old. We're not supposed to be hitchhiking. It's not a good thing to do. I knew that. And what upset me was, why didn't she know that? And before I could decide, my bus came. And I did make a decision to get on the bus. And I was looking at her out of the window and I was waving, but she didn't see me.
When Aiko doesn't return home, her mother raises the alarm. I return to Terry Medina. Did the authorities think she was a runaway? I mean, she's so young. Are they worried at this point?
She is young. This case is one of the ones in all of these that haunt me. So she disappeared from a bus stop in Berkeley, California. It's about 95 miles north of Santa Cruz County or Santa Cruz City. We really heard nothing about that case. She was reported missing by her mother. And, you know, later on, when we put these big task force together, we had Berkeley PD in the task force and Alameda County Sheriff's Office. And they reported that was a missing person, kind of a runaway. although there were detectives up there, I remember this so clearly, that believed this wasn't just a runaway young girl because she was raised by her mom. Her mom was a librarian at the University of California, Berkeley. She was her mother's entire life. Her mother made her clothes. Her mother raised her by herself. And the mother impressed on those officers up in that city that this was not a runaway. She absolutely believed it. And so there were, of course, all the posters on all the telephone poles and where is Aikoku? But it was mostly up there. Being a beach town, everybody figured if a kid runs away, they're going to run away to a beach town, and Santa Cruz was the closest beach town. So there was a few posters of her down by the beach in Santa Cruz. But other than that, it wasn't much of a connection to us at the sheriff's office or even at Santa Cruz PD until much, much later.
You mentioned that Aikoku was one of the hardest ones. And I mean, even looking at her, I'm pretty hard into all of this, but her face and her mom. And of course, everybody's life is valuable, but that little girl, how could he? How could he with any of them? But even he describes her differently than the rest.
Yes, he does. Edward Kemper almost describes it in a way that he wished she hadn't unlocked the car.
What's fascinating to me as a criminal psychologist is the way Kemper remembers every detail of his crimes. He has meticulously planned out how to entice victims, and he manipulates their vulnerabilities. Here's a short clip from Donald T. Lundy's interview with Edmund Kemper. Kemper recounts how it feels to commit his crimes and tells Lundy the story of how he kidnapped Aikoku.
I gather that you were able to go for a long period without thinking about it, or at least without it affecting you in this way?
As long as I was on the streets, from the time it happened, I started in Maine last year. First, it was scary, you know, doing something like that, because there's a hell of a lot of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how serious a thing I'd done until after it was done. It was just, that's weird. I didn't black out or anything, you know, it's just that I guess my sense of values were rather different.
Well, where'd you pick her up?
I picked her up in Berkeley, just as I did had the other two. She was going to San Francisco, and I went through San Francisco on the road, on the highway.
So how'd you dispose of that body? Where?
Into two different counties. Head and hands up in Alameda County.
And the rest in Santa Cruz?
Yeah.
The rest of Kemper's story, as he tells it to Dr. Lundy, is truly chilling. But for now, I continue talking to Terry Medina.
You know, let me remind you that now here's a 15-year-old. She does not know how to drive. She misses her bus to take her to ballet class in San Francisco. So she's looking frustrated. She's looking around. And Edmund Kemper is looking for a victim. And it's a perfect victim for him. He knows she's distraught, not paying attention, pulls over, offers her a ride. And out of, I think, desperation, she says yes. And that became the end of her right then and there. Although she wouldn't die for another 2 hours, probably.
So then, later on, when my mother showed me the clipping of Aiko's disappearance in the newspaper, I was really upset. I was really upset. I cried. I prayed. And I thought to myself, gee, Hazel, what if you were to stop and ran across the street? And I felt really horrible. I felt really horrible because I really cared about Aiko And I didn't want anything horrible to happen to her. And I was really sad that she hitchhiked. And I was confused. I was very confused. So, but it was, yeah, it was really horrible.
But there was more horror to come. Coming up, Santa Cruz's second serial killer, Herbert Mullen, begins his murder spree.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Janice from Warner Brothers Discovery. Spring is officially in bloom here in the Northern Hemisphere, and with a fresh season underway, you might be seeking your own transformation. For some, that means a new approach to weight loss or nutrition. Noom has a unique approach. Noom is tailored to each person's psychology and biology. It's built to meet you where you are because Noom understands that no two people are the same. Noom stands out to me because it offers a holistic approach to well-being. From coaching to recipes, Noom's app provides personalized information to help you on your journey. I also think it's great that Noom doesn't restrict what you can eat and it doesn't shame you for treating yourself, and treat yourself you should. What's more, Noom believes in nourishing rather than restricting. Noom can help you lose weight while still enjoying your favorite foods, because this approach is about eating well and treating your body right. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your free trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
For weeks, possibly months, Herbert Mullen has been falling deeper into his delusions, and he's begun formulating a plan to kill multiple people. On October 13, 2 months after Marianne Pesch's skull is found in the mountains, a 55-year-old homeless man named Lawrence White is found bludgeoned to death by a baseball bat. Here's Terry Medina.
So Larry White was our case, and Larry White was, he was just this nice old guy, and all the cops knew Lawrence White. He was one of quite a number of town alcoholics. He spent time in the county jail for being drunk and disorderly. But, you know, when he was sober, he was a very nice man. We all knew him. And his body was found on Highway 9, about maybe a mile or two up from Highway 1, kind of going up into a mountainous forested area. And his body is found right next to the pavement of the road itself. And it was clear that he'd been beaten to death about the head.
I can understand why the murder of Lawrence White appeared like an isolated attack.
He was a vulnerable person who may have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Perhaps there'd been an altercation. These types of crimes are tragic and heartbreaking, but they're also not unheard of. Yet what detectives didn't know, what nobody knew, is that this is far from an isolated incident. Lawrence White is the first of Herbert Mullen's victims, and Mullen is already scouting his second. Mullen would later tell Dr. Donald T. Lundy that he committed these murders to save California from a natural disaster. I speak to Emerson Murray, author of Murder Capital of the World.
It wasn't really until the UCSC murders started happening that people in Santa Cruz really started to say, hey, there's something going on here. You know, we understand there's bodies being found, but now there's something happening here. Herbert Mullen heard his parents' voices in his head, but on this occasion, he was driving by Cabrillo College, which is a local junior college, and out in front of the college was this big white Cadillac. And if you lived in the Valley at that time, you knew who owned this Cadillac. It was a man named Ray Liebenberg, and Ray Liebenberg was sort of a San Lorenzo Valley character. We all used to see him. He'd drive by in this big white Cadillac, and he had a long white beard, and it would be flapping out the window. And my parents would say, oh, there's Ray Liebenberg. And he was like an arborist or something to do with trees. I don't know exactly. And he had other jobs. I think he was a masseuse or something sort of unusual. And he had run for a supervisor, and I don't think he was successful with that. Well, Herbert Mullen knew who Ray Liebenberg was. And so he saw his car on the side of the road right in front of UCSC. And Ray Liebenberg's voice came into Herbert Mullen's head and said, you're going to need to kill someone for me. And so Mullen drove home, was thinking about that. And the next day, when he was driving by Cabrillo again, because he went to Cabrillo College, a woman was out there exactly where Ray Liebenberg's car was, and that was Mary Guilfoyle. And unfortunately, she had her thumb out and she was hitchhiking. And Mullen picked her up and immediately stabbed her in the chest. And he felt that she was supportive of this, and she supported his idea that she was sacrificing herself to stop natural disasters because she had slumped onto the floor so that nobody else could see her. So she was helping him get away with the crime. So that was really...
That was a sign.
Yeah.
A sign that she was okay with this.
Yeah.
At this point, it's important to note that Ray Liebenberg had never been involved in any real discussion with Mullen. The conversation was all imagined in Mullen's head. The bodies and missing persons were starting to add up, and neither Mullen nor Kemper were on anyone's list of suspects. To further understand how daunting a prospect solving 21 horrific homicides was at the time, I want to dial back a little to understand the culture of law enforcement in the 1970s. Terry Medina, what was it like to be a detective? How did you become a detective, and what kind of crimes were you dealing with every day?
You know, so for getting selected to be a detective was just an evolution. So I was with the Sheriff's Department at the time. We were the largest law enforcement agency in the county. The city of Santa Cruz had its own police department, and they were fairly large. And the cities of Capitola and Scotts Valley were very small. They had their own police department, but Capitola had one detective. Scotts Valley had one. So the sheriff's office, we had about eight or nine probably. And the way you got there was just an evolution in management, looking at your whole body of work. There's no computers in those days. So how well you could write, how well you could spell, how legible your handwriting was. When you were a patrol officer, did you make a lot of arrests? What did the district attorney's lawyers think of you as a witness in court? All those things kind of went into a selection process of people. And so I wound up being a detective in 1970.
Before all of these major homicides began, what type of work were you doing? I mean, the day-to-day crime, what would you have to deal with at this point?
Typically, we would have five or six homicides a year in our jurisdiction. Santa Cruz City would have maybe three or four a year. We had nobody in the county, including us in the sheriff's office, dedicated to homicide. We had eight or nine detectives. One of them was dedicated solely to bad checks and fraud. And the rest of us worked robberies, burglaries, grand theft, things like that, what I call vanilla crimes. When a murder case did occur, everybody dropped what they were doing, and two guys get assigned to the murder case, or four. Just depends on what was unfolding.
As a psychologist, I can't help but be acutely aware of the impact that crimes of this nature have on those like Terry, who are tasked with investigating them. I want to talk a little bit about the impact of these murders and disappearances on you and Mickey, and how important it was to have him, to have someone to have this bond with.
Well, Mickey and I were born and raised in Santa Cruz. He a little bit older than I, and he had fought in Vietnam. He joined the sheriff's office a few years after I did, but we had known each other from when we were much younger, growing up. And we wound up in the investigation bureau together. But you know, during this time, there's so much going on. Every single person in the detective bureau, and we got very, very, very close. We worked hard, we played hard, we drank too much. Mickey and I, we shared a lot of sadness together. We shared a lot of everything, you know, and not to mention what's going on in our life. You know, in my life, I was married, had a small child, and all these, you know, working all these nights and never coming home didn't help anything.
That must have been harrowing for you.
I think what happens to police officers that do this, and in big cities, there are detectives that are just solely homicide detectives, but people that do this, whether they're in the coroner section or homicide or like us back then, you're so focused on what you're doing, you try not to let the true trauma and ugliness of what human beings do to one another get inside you. And everybody handles it in a different way. I mean, I said we worked hard and we played hard. We worked so many hours, and there were some bars that told us where the key was so we could unlock the door and go in and drink in a bar after we were, no matter what time of the day or night it was.
You probably needed that.
Yeah. So you just got so tight, like a cohesive unit. You laughed together, you felt bad together, and you just try to drive through it. Because there's a job to do. I know you hear that all the time, but you keep doing it.
Terry's partner, Mickey, has similar recollections from the time. What was it like for you to roll up onto these crime scenes? How did you cope?
You have a tendency to build a defense mechanism. You look at some of the things, maybe with the Calamagallo sense of humor. You try to distance yourself emotionally from it. There was another homicide in Santa Cruz about the same time that wasn't associated with Mullen or Kemper, but it was a young girl. Her stepfather, they were camping, and he got irritated and threw her across the campsite and hit her head on a log, and it severed her spinal cord. I couldn't attend the autopsy because this little girl looked exactly like my oldest daughter. So I couldn't go. I had to have somebody else fill in for me.
I couldn't imagine.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. It's really terrible.
Did you ever feel like quitting?
Not at this time, because everything was happening so quick. You know, we just wanted to get out there and do the best job that we possibly could. There are times within your career, you know, they used to call it the 7-year itch. When you've been there for 7-8 years, you're thinking about moving on to something else. And, you know, I think I thought about that, but I never did. I just stayed with it for all 41 years.
Shortly after the Second World War, a French resistant fighter from Marseille emigrated to the United States. His name was Henry Thomae, and by the time the murders had started in Santa Cruz, he was working as a priest at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Los Gatos, California. I returned to Emerson Murray. Can you tell us about the murder of Father Henry Thomae?
Herbert Mullen had gone to San Francisco to pay a $10 premium on a life insurance policy that he had. And so on his way home from San Francisco, he was drinking beer and whiskey. And I'm not exactly sure how he came across the church, because it's not right off of Highway 17, but it's close. So he went into the church, and his idea was that he was going to pray and he was going to build strength to never kill again. He had already killed two people. So he went into the church and he saw that Father Henry Thomae was in the confessional. The light was on in the confessional. And so he went and knocked on the door really hard. And Henry Thomae, I guess, didn't answer right away. And he went to leave, and then Henry Thomae opened the door, and Mullen immediately started stabbing him to death. According to Mullen, he had never planned to do that. It just was spur of the moment, opportunistic chance.
Whatever the circumstances of Mullen's meeting with Father Thomae, we know from his interviews with Donald T. Lundy just after his arrest that there was a deeply disturbing psychology behind the killings. He claimed that his victims communicated with him subconsciously to agree to their own murder, or sacrifice, as Mullen phrased it. His delusions were rooted in a warped understanding of the Bible, as this interview extract demonstrates.
You know, I mean, you read in the Bible about Jonah. There was 12 men in the boat. Jonah was in the boat. You know, it's just like Jesus, you know. And Jonah stood up and said, God, darn, man, if we don't, you know, if somebody doesn't die, all 13 of us are going to die. So he jumped overboard. You know, he was drowned.
Police get a lead on the murder of Henry Thomae when a witness claims to have seen a tall young man wearing dark clothes and boots flee the church. Their line of inquiry focuses on the notion that it's a burglary gone wrong. What is undeniable is that more than any other case so far, this case sends shockwaves throughout the area. And why wouldn't it? People go missing all the time, but it's not often a priest gets slaughtered in his own confessional. I return to Terry Medina.
So, yeah, this one hit everybody pretty hard. So the priest is killed in his own church in Los Gatos, California. Just before you get down into San Jose, there's this little city called Los Gatos. And it's a beautiful little town, kind of an upscale community, really nice Catholic church there on the edge of town. And he's killed in his own confessional. So it's not our case, but the news about a priest being killed in his own church, in his own confessional, just exploded all over the San Francisco Bay Area, all the networks. It drew national attention. And what I remember about that was talking to my partner, Mickey Luffy, and all the other detectives, like, thank God, you know, we don't have to deal with that one. Little did we know later on we would be dealing with it in a different context.
As 1972 draws to a close, seeing all of the cases combined, a pattern begins to emerge. Only it's a pattern that has the potential to lead investigators astray. We have four young female hitchhikers missing, one of whose skull has been found in the mountains. Three have been taken by Kemper, one by Mullen, neither of whom are on the law enforcement's radar. We have a seemingly random attack on a homeless man and another seemingly random attack on a priest. The cases cross county lines, they're confusing, and there's very little forensic evidence to work with. But with the disappearances and murders mounting, law enforcement begin to ask each other the unthinkable. Could there be a serial killer on the loose? Next time, we follow the case as it continues to unfold, as Kemper's and Mullen's murder sprees escalate, and the once serene setting of Santa Cruz turns into a bloodbath. Mind of a Monster, The Co-Ed Killer and Herbert Mullen is brought to you by Arrow Media for ID. Your host is Dr. Michelle Ward. You can follow our show wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love it if you could take a second to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.